Now, from Mayo Clinic, it's Medical Edge Weekend, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. Plus, we'll take you beyond the headlines for in-depth discussions of what developments in medicine mean to you. Information you want from specialists who know. Join the conversation by phone, through our blog, or on Twitter by going to radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Medical Edge Weekend. Well, Tracy, there's one thing I know for sure, and that is that being a parent has changed a lot since you and I grew up, or at least since I grew up.
Oh, a lot, yes. I grew up, too. That's true.
As an example, you know, my brother and I did something bad once. And then we got the belt, and we never did it again.
Well, you were smart enough not to make the mistake twice.
Exactly.
That's what it was.
You know, talking doesn't seem to work as well,
at least
for me. But parenting can be a huge challenge. There's no question about that. And just figuring out where to begin when raising your own kids in today's world, and certainly you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
There is no cookie-cutter solution for excellent parenting in this century. But with enough love and humor and patience and practical advice from people who care and the books you read, maybe it is possible to figure it out. I always liked the quote from the guy who wrote the book called The Business of Life. His name was William Feather. And he said, setting a good example for your children takes all the fun out of middle age.
Well, that is true, yes.
Parenting is important, no question about that. But one of the people who can help you along the way and help you along a lot, at least we've found in our family, is a medical specialist called a pediatrician.
Today on Medical Edge Weekend, we'll talk with one of those. We have one here, someone who cares about the health of your children, Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg. She's part of the Mayo Clinic Health System from Albert Lea, Minnesota. We'll talk to her about well child checks and find out when you should first establish a relationship with that pediatrician, probably sooner than you think.
Early on.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We'll talk about fever, ear infections, and the common cold. We'll get her advice on screen time, how much time you should allow your kids in front of the TV, the computer, the iPod, et cetera, and of course playing video games too.
Yep, the screen time stuff is difficult to control, I can assure you. Now, you're not quite there yet, I don't think, with your kids. They haven't reached the teenage years, but teenagers are glued to their phones.
That's true. It's already happening.
Before we meet Dr. Stoltenberg, there's one issue that I wanted to bring up, and it's about red meat. Red meat got a bad rap this week, and I love steak, and I even love almost as much as I love cheeseburgers. So, it was bad news for me, but it was a Harvard study that came out on Monday that said that eating a single serving of red meat every day might increase the risk of early death by 13%. And the research went on to say that a daily serving of processed meat, that's a hot dog or a couple of strips of bacon, carries an even greater risk, a 20% increased risk of early death.
Why do we have to include bacon in this list?
That's right. And to add fuel to the fire, I think you saw this story. There's a new billboard that they put up in Chicago, huge billboard that says, "Hot dogs cause butt cancer."
Oh, it was put up by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a nonprofit organization that promotes preventative medicine, animal rights, and plant-based diets, obviously trying to stir the pot just a little bit.
Yeah, and they use the word butt because surveys show that almost 40% of people don't know what the colon is, don't realize that the colon is the lower part of the bowel that is subject to cancer. So colorectal cancer, 40% of people don't know what that means. So I thought we had to talk to my friend, Dr. Donald Hensrud, nutrition expert and author of the Mayo Clinic diet book. Dr. Donald Hensrud, he's on the phone. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Hensrud.
Happy to be here, Tom.
All right. What's the deal?
Well, this created a little bit of a stir. This was a study, actually two studies, of almost 120,000 people followed for 28 years. So it had a lot of power. The study was done by Harvard, and it was actually a pretty good study. It's also consistent with other studies that have shown that increased red meat intake is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, certain cancers, as you pointed out, colon cancer, probably prostate cancer, and type 2 diabetes. The real issue here, I think, is how to interpret the results. So if you think about what determines what we eat, it isn't always the scientific information. It's our more subjective factors. our taste preferences, what we're used to eating, what we grew up eating. And for me to tell you to stop eating meat, I don't think that would go over real well. We all eat. We all have feelings, sometimes strong, about what's good nutrition. I think the important thing here is putting this in perspective. If people do eat meat, go for quality instead of quantity and cut down on the portion size. Or couple times a week, if you like fish, try fish, or even vegetarian. So I don't think we need to, you know, make wholesale changes for everyone. That's not realistic. But the study does stand out there, and I think we need to listen to the results. If people want to go a little bit more emotional, like the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, that's kind of using the stick approach rather than the carrot approach. I think there are more positive ways of promoting good nutrition than that, however.
Dr. Hinsrud, didn't one of these studies also say something about diet soda?
I don't know if this study here looked at it, but diet soda in other studies has been shown, interestingly enough, to be associated with slightly increased weight. Now, it's better than regular soda, but even then, one of the theories is it may trick our brain into eating sweet foods at other times. Obviously, diet soda doesn't have any calories in it. And I think overall, we need to look at the total diet and good health and enjoying food and not really putting the big black X on it.
So red meat is okay in moderation, and quality cuts are better than processed. You, I assume, are not a big fan of hot dogs?
Well, as this study pointed out, processed meats such as bacon, hot dogs, salami, and other things, they have additional salt. They sometimes have nitrosamines, and that may have an additional health risk. So it's even more important to watch, I think, the total amount that we consume of those things. Now, am I going to tell somebody to go to the ballpark and not have a hot dog? No, I'm not. But just keep it down to a dull roar, I think, is the message here.
Well, and just like you're saying, you know, enjoy beef in moderation, enjoy red meat in moderation, that every once in a while you can throw in a vegetarian meal and not say, oh, I'm a vegetarian now. You just have a vegetarian meal to balance out the steak that you had the night before.
That's right. Shift the balance of the diet. So one of the things, you know, we tell people what not to eat all the time. It's just as important what to eat. And there's no holds barred on vegetables, fruits, and plant products. So we need to make this an enjoyable message.
Right. Everything in moderation.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Hey, Dr. Donald Hinsrud, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate
Happy
your time.
Happy to be here, Tom.
All righty. Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg from Albert Lea, Minnesota, part of the Mayo Clinic Health System. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. My first question is, do you like kids?
I love kids. They're a lot of fun.
Does every pediatrician love kids?
You know, it tends to be that way, because otherwise we really went into the wrong field.
Are female pediatricians better than male pediatricians?
Ooh, loaded question. Gee, see, and here I have a bias, but I probably shouldn't share that. It is, we have noticed that more women are going into pediatrics, and the balance of men or women in pediatrics has shifted to be more women. So it used to be about 30% of general pediatricians were women, and now in pediatricians under about age 45, it's more like 63-65%.
No
Let's
kidding.
Talk about when you should make a relationship with a pediatrician. So when do you suggest that somebody find a pediatrician for their child?
In an ideal world, you've thought about it even before your little boy or girl has arrived. Mm. Being familiar with the practitioners in your area, maybe even meeting with one of the pediatricians to talk with them, get an idea of what their philosophies are, get a chance to talk about maybe any concerns you have going into parenthood, letting them know about possibly some things in your family history ahead of time can be really beneficial. Often you can get a good feeling about whether or not this is somebody that you and your spouse are going to click with and be able to establish a good relationship with just in that initial meeting.
It's important because there's so much change that happens for a child. I mean, you have all these wild well child visits mm-hmm. through all of these years, and now my kids are getting into the every other year stage, which just seems crazy because I still remember the every 3 months, every 6 months, you know, whatever the situation. So it's surprising to me that a pediatrician is not part of the game plan for all parents right out of the gate.
That's true. Sometimes people haven't thought about that part of their child's health care until after their baby's arrived. It may be just that initial time when the obstetricians or the nurses mention to you, by the way, who did you want us to call and let know that your baby has arrived? Many of the times we establish that first relationship with the families there in the hospital after their child has been born. And that's fine. We're going to have lots of time to get to know each other as we watch your child grow. But again, if you have the opportunity to at least make yourself familiar with who's available in your area ahead of time, it really does start that relationship off before there are ever any concerns.
My kids are 7 and 10. And in the few short years that they have been on this planet, a lot has already changed for kids. One of them being fevers.
Yes.
Now we just, if the fever isn't just a raging, super high fever, we just are supposed to just let fevers go. And that's hard to do as a parent because you think, oh my gosh, I have to prevent this. But it actually is good for a child to have a fever that's not too high.
Absolutely. The idea of not necessarily treating fevers is something that as pediatricians, we may be whispered in the back rooms or shared with you in your visit, but we're becoming more vocal about that. A fever is the body's natural response to an illness. Most of the time you get a fever if your child's fighting an illness. And that fever can, in fact, help your child's body fight that illness and get rid of it sooner. So a reason to treat a fever is if your child is uncomfortable with it. Certainly if they seem fussy or they're refusing to drink, because we certainly don't want them to get dehydrated.
Sure.
But just treating the fever for the sake of getting that temperature in their body down isn't necessary.
How high is too high? Because if it gets too high, they can have seizures and they can risk some other medical complications from it. So how high is too high of a fever?
When do you need to call the doctor?
That really depends on your child's age. In the first, let me take a step back. As pediatricians, we consider anything over 100.4, so 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit, or 38 degrees Celsius, a fever. So if your child's 99 degrees Fahrenheit, certainly they might feel a little warmer, but we don't give them credit for having a full fever. If your child is less than 3 months old and their temperature goes above that magic line, the 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or the 38 degrees Celsius, we want you to call us day or night. Your child should be seen. When you're under 3 months of age, the chance of that fever being the first sign of something that could be more serious is more likely.
Sure.
Now, as you get older, as your child is getting to be 6 months to 2 years, usually as long as that fever stays under about 101, you're fine, or as long as it's not lasting for more than 2 to 4 days. When you start getting over 2 years old or you're getting into the school age, really, fevers even going as high as 104, 105, while definitely uncomfortable, are not dangerous.
Other things to keep them comfortable.
Exactly. Lukewarm baths, not cold baths, because if your child's already warm, even a lukewarm bath is going to feel pretty cool. Keeping them unwrapped. So even if grandma says bundle them up real tight, don't do it. You want to let them cool off, let them be around in their diaper or their underwear, and really push fluids. It's amazing how much just staying hydrated can help make you feel more comfortable. And then the days of recommending like an alcohol bath, a rubbing alcohol bath, we really don't recommend that anymore.
A lot has changed.
Yeah.
In what you said, the grandma component. That's interesting because what you used to do now has shifted, and there's other things that you do. But when that's the way that you were raised, that's what you think you should still do.
Absolutely. And again, I always tell people, don't hesitate to call. Going back to your question of when should you call your pediatrician, you should call your pediatrician if you're worried. If at any point you're worried, give us a call. There's no such thing as a silly question. On the other hand, as long as your child's acting okay, their fever hasn't gone out of that range that I mentioned, and they're staying hydrated, you can usually just watch them and take care of them at home, give them a nice comfy place to be on the couch, read them some good books, and enjoy some snuggle time because they'll be wanting to get up and run around soon enough. So
a fever is a good thing, but it can be too high. And you gave us some guidelines about when you ought to call your pediatrician or your... Do you have any problem if a family says, you know, we have a great family doctor and a good relationship with him and we want him to see our child? Do you have any problem with that?
No. Most of the time you'll find that the pediatricians and the family family practitioners work together very well. Yeah. And if at any point your family pediatrician, your family practitioner, excuse me, feels at all uncomfortable, they'll contact a pediatrician. Sure. Yeah.
Our guest is pediatrician Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg from the Mayo Clinic in Albert Lea, Minnesota. Time for a short break. Coming up, myth or matter of fact, your child needs a daily multivitamin. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for pediatrician Dr. Stoltenberg at 507-282-1234 or contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us at hashtag Mayo Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend. We are talking with the kids doctor, Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg of the Mayo Clinic in Albert Lea, Minnesota. And we have got some myths or matter of facts that we need straightened out right from you, Dr. Stoltenberg.
Excellent.
On our Facebook page, there's always a lot of discussion when we put these myth or matter of fact facts up there. So here's our first one. Your child needs a daily multivitamin. Myth or matter of fact?
That would be a myth.
Oh,
we can throw a little matter of fact in there, but most of the time it's a myth. In most children that are eating a healthy, balanced diet, who don't have any medical concerns, they do not need a multivitamin daily. An exception to that would be little babies, especially breastfed babies, should be getting some extra vitamin D on a daily basis.
If mom is having extra vitamin D, does the breastfed baby get the extra vitamin D?
Not enough to make as much of a difference as what we'd like to see. Now, this is something that as pediatricians, we're still batting back and forth. But
yeah, this is news to me.
Yeah, on average, we're going to be recommending some daily vitamin D intake.
Interesting.
So just as a single vitamin?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it comes in a liquid
dropper
form. Absolutely.
All right, so every woman who breastfeeds should give their baby vitamin D. Can we put that on the Facebook?
You go for it.
it's already in the Twitter sphere.
I was going to say, it's escaped now. I've said it out loud.
All right, there you go.
Myth or matter of fact, a green or a yellow runny nose means that your child has a sinus infection and needs antibiotics.
This is one of my favorites because we probably do hear this most every day. That is a myth. Green or yellowish nasal discharge does not always mean that there's a sinus infection in there. It usually means that that mucus has sat in there for a while, and it would be good to help rinse that out. And you can do that with some nasal saline drops. They make wonderful big bottles of that the whole family can use.
Wildly unpopular at my house.
it's really not necessarily a good time, but it falls into that good for you category.
Right.
Or even just being in the tub or in the bathroom and allowing that steam to help moisten up the mucus and allow you to blow it out. And then just blowing the nose, which is not necessarily as easy as it sounds, can be a big help to get that stuff out of your nose.
Don't you think that a lot of parents bring their kid in expecting and wanting an antibiotic and think their child needs an antibiotic? What do you tell them?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to hear the reasons for why they're worried about their child. So definitely we want to talk through what sort of symptoms they're seeing. How long has the drainage been there? Have they had fevers along with it? Is there any facial pain? But on average, most of the time, no. If there haven't been any of those concerning signs, they don't need the antibiotics. And we talk a lot about why they don't need the antibiotics.
So you explain it to them.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think we're becoming a more savvy population, and fewer people now are coming in and expecting the antibiotics than they were even just a couple years ago.
Wow, that's good to hear.
It is. It's
big
great
change
to see.
Yeah. Myth or matter of fact, you shouldn't let your children sleep in your bed.
Oh.
So we're just throwing you right into the fire.
I do.
Welcome to Medical Edge, Dr.
I'm visualizing the billboards on I-35 that are going to come up now with my picture on them in effigy. The American Academy of Pediatrics does not recommend sharing a bed with your child on a regular basis. And I want to emphasize that last part. Certainly, we recognize that there would be different times. But especially with young children and infants, there are concerns for SIDS. Blankets can get on top of children. Children can fall in between the cracks of mattresses if they're those separated mattresses. parents could potentially roll over on their child.
Yeah, that's a heartbreaking story when that hits the news every once in a while. And it's rare. That's why it hits the news, it's because it rarely happens, but it does happen.
SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, is more common when the child is sleeping with the parents?
That is a risk factor that increases the likelihood.
Wow.
Yes. With that said, though, having young babies in a child-safe bed, like a bassinet with a firm mattress or a crib with a firm mattress, in the parent's room lowers the risk. So not in your bed, but in the same room. And that can also really help with breastfeeding and things like that.
Co-sleepers. They make co-sleepers for that. Very fancy.
Do. They are.
As a 6-year thumb sucker, I will ask, myth or matter of fact, thumb sucking is bad and you should do whatever it takes to stop it. I should say I no longer suck my thumb, but I did for 6 years.
Well, I think I did it for 7 or 8.
Should you do whatever it takes to stop it, Dr. Stoltenberg?
It's good to encourage children and draw their attention to it, but no, it doesn't need to be a forceful situation. You don't ever want to make it. If a lot of times with kids, they're pretty smart, and if you pressure them on something, then it becomes a battle of wills, and we lose.
Gotcha.
They will win. So I think it's important to talk with them, to maybe even draw their attention to it. But also make sure that they have something else as a security feature, and most kids will just take care of it on their own.
I had one. Did you have a little blankie?
Absolutely.
Oh, Kleenex. I used a Kleenex.
When I also figured out, if they put that bad-smelling stuff, tasting stuff on there, you keep at it. You can lick it off. You get rid of it.
Yeah, it doesn't tend to work
real
well.
And for a surgeon to be sucking his thumb, that's very troubling. So we're glad that he changed his ways.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend with pediatrician Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Right after that, your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Your comments and questions from our website and your tweets at #MayoRadio. This is Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend.
Medical Edge Weekend is pre-recorded. To join in, go to radio.mayoclinic.org. You'll find links to next week's episode, upcoming programs, and how to listen live. Have a question? Leave us a note in the comments section or tweet us at #MayoRadio. Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with a look at health and medical news. Now, here's some information red meat eaters might want to hear. Eating more red meat appears to be associated with an increased risk of death. That's according to a study published by Archives of Internal Medicine. The study shows eating more red meat may increase the risk of death from cardiovascular disease and cancer, but substituting other foods, including fish and poultry, for red meat is associated with a lower mortality risk. Now, meat is a major source of protein and fat in many diets. So researchers from the Harvard School of Public Health estimated that replacing one serving of red meat with one serving of fish, poultry, nuts, legumes, low-fat dairy products, or whole grains daily could lower that risk. And moving on, screaming, punching out, jumping out of bed. These are some of the things people with a sleep disorder called REM behavioral disorder do when they're asleep. And crazy nights aren't the only issues. People with symptoms of rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder have twice the risk of developing mild cognitive impairment or Parkinson's disease within 4 years of diagnosis of the sleep problem, compared with people without the disorder. Here's Dr. Brad Beauvais.
REM sleep behavior disorder is what's called a parasomnia, so an unpleasant behavior or activity that happens at night. Normally in REM sleep, we're paralyzed, at least most of the muscles in our body are paralyzed, and so we tend not to talk or scream and don't act out with our arms or legs. But in this disorder, people lose that normal paralysis, and so they literally appear to act out dreams.
Dr. Beauvais says understanding that certain patients are at greater risk for MCI or Parkinson's disease will allow for early intervention. Now, researchers continue to search for effective treatments, but the best chance of success is to identify and treat these disorders early. And now let's talk about treating psoriasis to prevent heart attacks and strokes. A clinical study co-led by the Montreal Heart Institute and Innovaderm Research, Inc. shows that a new treatment for psoriasis could be associated with a significant decrease in vascular inflammation, a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Psoriasis is a chronic inflammatory disease of the skin and joints that affects about 3% of the population. It's associated with a greater risk of heart attack and stroke. The goal of the study was to show that a treatment to reduce skin inflammation in psoriasis patients could be associated with a decrease in vascular inflammation. The study had positive results, including that vascular inflammation decreased in patients treated with what's called adalimumab. Researchers say the research is good news for people with psoriasis. And that's a look at health and medical news. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend. Our guest is pediatrician Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg. She works at the Albert Lee Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Stoltenberg, that brings up the topic of teenagers, and that brings up the topic of cell phones, video games, and TV, and how do you control it all?
That is a great question, and one that becomes challenging the minute they figure out that there's an iPod. We laugh at my house. I have a nearly three-year-old, and he can operate a lot of that technology more quickly than I can. But certainly when they get to be teenagers, it becomes even more of a challenge. They're using it for their schoolwork, and then they're using it for their social connection and just for fun. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no more than 2 hours of screen time
total.
A day.
So TV, total. Video games.
That includes
DS.
The phone?
That's
yep.
The phone. That's the iPod. That's texting your friends to see what they're doing tonight.
Engineer has a teenage son and he's laughing and laughing. So even for teenagers, 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
How about for adults? 2 hours.
Really, it would be the best thing for us yeah. too, because the time that you're spending in front of the screen looking at the cell phone, doing things on your computer, you're not up and moving around and doing things.
I was so glad that I heard the recommendation that under 2 should have no screen time.
Exactly.
I heard that after my kids were 2 years old. So then I didn't have to feel guilty
about it. You blew
that
one, didn't you?
I just had to feel guilty about it. Oh, missed the boat on that one.
Well, you know, I think it will require a crowbar to get the cell phone out of my daughter's hand. But so it's not easy, I can tell you that. And by the way, we want you to join our program, 507-282-1234. Questions for pediatrician Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg. You can also contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can tweet us at #MayoRadio. And for our callers, we have a couple of books to give away, The Mayo Clinic Guide to a Healthy Pregnancy. And it also has a section in there is called Managing as Parents, Chapter 19,
oh,
Early Survival Tips, Parenting as a Team, and Finding Time for Yourself.
That should be Chapter 1, not Chapter 19. 282-1234. Let's go to the phones. Barbara has a question about her grandson. Good morning, Barbara. Welcome to Medical Edge. Go right ahead. Do you have a question?
Do great things. I'm calling about my grandson who is 10 years old. He is in the lower percentile of growth, and they have found his thyroid is enlarged. Smooth, they said. But I was wondering if you think that this is something very serious because he is small for his age.
And again, he is 10 years old.
10 years old.
And an enlarged thyroid.
Yes.
All right.
Although, and he is in the lower 10% of his growth.
One quick question on that. Have they checked thyroid levels, done what would be called like a TSH or a thyroid stimulating hormone?
Yes, they have done. He lives in the cities, and they at the University of Minnesota have done blood tests. We have not heard from them yet. And
okay.
I was wondering, does it sound like it could affect his growth, or can you tell me that?
I certainly can. Our thyroid is something that can affect our growth. Even as we get older, not having enough thyroid hormone can cause us to gain extra weight. Having too much can cause you to lose some weight. So I think that it sounds like they've done exactly the right things for the next step. His parents have done a great job of getting him in to see somebody. It sounds like they've been following his growth, and I think the next step is waiting to see what those lab results show.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in, Barbara.
All right. Thank you.
Barbara brings up an excellent point. It's one of my biggest gripes as a parent with pediatrics is the 10th percentile, because my kids were 40th percentile. And when you take a test, you flunk if you are below the 70th percentile. And so I always think that it makes me feel bad. When I was a brand new parent, I thought, what am I doing wrong? My kid is the 30th percentile. My child is the 40th percentile. And then my son came along and was even less. And I was just, it makes you really nervous. And so when she said he's in the 10th percentile, I mean, what does that exactly mean?
That's a great question, and I will be very honest, and this is not the appropriate pediatrician answer. This is the Heidi answer. I hate percentiles with weights because I think that they can be misleading. The reason we use those is we have what are called growth curves, and every time your child comes in, we put their height, their weight, sometimes their head, the size of their head circumference on those charts, and we're looking to see what their growth is over time. So really, 10th percentile, if that's where he's always been, is just fine.
Yeah.
That's him. And somebody has to be there.
But see, for people like Barbara, it does make you concerned when you go, he's only the 10th percentile.
I mean,
because it does sound like failure, but it's actually not, as long as they stay on that curve.
Right, exactly. And so what I'm looking for, and I don't like to give out percentiles unless specifically asked, because I think it can be misleading. 90th percentile doesn't necessarily mean you get an A. If you're in the 10th percentile, so you're more petite for your height, but your weight is in the 90th percentile, that's a mismatch. So we want to see height and weight gaining steadily as the child gets older, and then we want to see them be proportional to each other.
When you become queen, will you please change that? Because yeah. I think it
Absolutely.
Causes a lot of heartache and headache for brand new parents.
I agree. I mean, and I had the opposite. I had a little boy that was born early who went from being very small, even though he was being compared to kids that were born a couple months later, mm-hmm. to being a nice big boy now, but everything's proportional,
sure.
and he's fine. But it is. It's hard. The pediatrician part of my brain said, that's just fine. And the mommy part of my brain, it broke my heart.
Makes so you feel like a failure.
Exactly.
You are a person who really is embracing social media and the technology
yes.
and how that can help you and your patients. And so people are asking over the last little while, starting asking you questions using social media.
Yes, it's actually been... It started out very informally. I had an account on Facebook, was using it actually to communicate for a high school reunion, and then started receiving friend requests from parents of families that I would see. And it's turned out to be a really great tool for me to not only provide information, new research that might be out, product recalls, to get those to their homes and in all their hands, even if I'm not seeing them in the near future. But it's also been a really nice venue. I've gotten some questions sent through like a personal message that I could tell that they didn't necessarily want to call in and talk to anybody else about it, but they did kind of want to run it by me. They knew I knew their child, and so they felt comfortable reaching out in that way.
It's another avenue to reach you.
Yeah, and an avenue that's not necessarily bounded by time.
Here is one that is a question coming into us through Facebook. You can also
Great.
Tweet us with your questions at hashtag Mayo Radio, or go to our webpage, radio.mayoclinic.org. A question about a granddaughter who's eating sand. So you said, you know, is the child 2 or is the child 20? That makes a difference. But let's just go right down the middle and say that this is an 8-year-old child that is eating sand. What does that mean?
It can mean nothing, or it could mean that they are low on some minerals in their diet. Specifically, iron tends to be the most common. So it's a good idea to talk with the child's provider and possibly get an iron test. Just to make sure that they're getting enough iron.
Very good.
You think it suggests that the child could possibly be lacking in some nutrient that you can find in sand, or she just likes sand?
And it could go either way.
Yeah.
And then that's why it's a good thing to talk to your provider about, because it may just be that she likes sand.
Feels good
it feels good
hands.
In the mouth.
That's
it feels
right,
good in the
yeah.
fingers. So, yeah, but certainly you do want to get that checked, because it could be something that we call pica, which means eating things that aren't food. And one of the causes of that can be not having enough of iron or other nutrients in your body.
All right. If you would like to talk to the provider, we are at 507-282-1234. She is pediatrician Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg of Albert Lea.
Another thing that has changed in the last few years is you can't buy a cough medicine for children to save your life. Now, honey, we're going back to the old school. We're like Little House on the Prairie. If your child has a cough, you give them honey. So what's going on?
And that's come about for a lot of different reasons. But one of the big things that happened was there were children. They're laughing at me because they're going into these murky waters with me. one of the things that happened was there were children that were actually being overdosed, and there were some deaths of children. And if you look at products on the shelves these days, it's not just, oh, here's a product for cough. It's cold multi-symptom.
Sure.
And so that could mean anything that has lots of different ingredients. And people were getting two or three multi-system medications and were duplicating medications and then having bad things happen. So the companies voluntarily said, okay, we'll either stop making the products or we'll label them as only for six and above, sometimes four and above. The American Academy of Pediatrics has said, usually 2 years and above, it's okay, but do that with your doctor's guidance. The thing with the honey is, you know, sometimes those things that we did 100 years ago, we did because they worked. And so the one thing to remember is unpasteurized or whole honey isn't safe under a year. So don't give children under a year products containing honey, and just because there's always the possibility that there could be a concern.
Oh, and when you tell the child, oh, you know what, here, have a big spoonful of honey, they look at you like it's Christmas morning. Like, what? I get to have honey? 282-1234, good morning. Welcome to Medical Edge. Sue, you have a child who has an issue with teeth?
Yeah, my son has always hated to brush his teeth, and we have a daily battle, and he is 12 years old, and I'm wondering if there's any recommendations.
Normal. It's normal.
I was hoping you were going to say four, but 12 is a much farther down the road. What should she do, Dr. Stoltenberg?
Oh, that's such a great question, and you're not alone. We get this question, so it's not just your son.
I can guarantee you it's not just your son. Yep.
A lot of times it can be for different reasons. I don't know if your son has shared with you. Is it that he just doesn't like the sensation? Does it hurt? Has he mentioned anything in particular on why he doesn't want to?
No, I know he doesn't like the mint-flavored toothpaste, so we've gotten the bubble gum and all the different fruity-flavored ones, but he just refuses to brush his teeth. He doesn't mind flossing, which is good.
Yep, absolutely.
But it's obvious that he doesn't brush his teeth because his teeth are more yellow than anybody else in the house, and I'm afraid he's not going to have teeth by the time he's 25.
Wait until a girl comes into the picture.
Absolutely.
Isn't that a big part? I have actually heard that's a big part of the solution here.
No, it certainly is, especially with young men, as they start to want to attract female attention. God bless you all, boys out there. You start to take showers more willingly and wash your face and your hair more willingly. And I love you all, but you sometimes give your folks challenges. But yeah, just continue. I think it sounds like you're doing a great thing as far as finding different flavors of toothpaste. He's certainly old enough to understand that this is just part of what you have
and
to
he's
do.
And flossing. That's impressive.
Yeah, that is. I mean, you know, you got to sort of say, you know, you either are going to brush your teeth or I'm going to brush them for you.
Yeah. And he's old enough to get that.
Yeah.
You know, when they're four, it's a little harder to rationalize through with them. Certainly talk to him about whether he'd prefer a motorized or a non-motorized toothbrush. Some people don't like the sensation of the motorized. Some people prefer it.
She's tried it all, haven't you, Sue?
I have, but I'm wondering if there's like any of the water pick type of toothbrushes and that sort of thing I should try.
Give it a try. Yeah,
whatever works.
I think it's a situation where trying different things aren't going to hurt and they might help. Another thing that can be helpful, you can talk with your dentist about having them do a fluoride wash or a fluoride coating, which protects the teeth for up to 6 months. And that can really, really, really help protect those teeth while you're struggling with this.
And the other thing, Sue, is it'll get better.
It
will happen that they will want to brush their teeth when they get to be teenagers.
Thanks for calling in, Sue.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Thanks a lot.
What about, first I have to ask, when do you stop taking your child to a pediatrician and transition into a GP, to a general practitioner?
That is a great question because some people think that pediatricians only see small children, and we love our teenagers. So usually about 19 to 20 is when most practices say it's time to find a quote-unquote adult doctor.
Sure.
That's assuming that the child doesn't make some lifestyle choices that mean that they need a different kind of specialist. So if a teenage girl would ever become pregnant, we want them to be seeing an obstetrician and a gynecologist. But the truth is we've got a few older kids that just kind of finish up with us till they're done with college and are on their own insurance, and we're okay with that.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
And what about, speaking of teenagers, HPV? Because that is bumping younger and younger to 12, 11, 10-year-olds, for boys now as well. Again, something new on the face of medicine that they didn't have 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
And that's a really current recommendation. We've been recommending that human papillomavirus, which is the virus, sometimes people hear it called, that it causes genital warts, but it also has, certain versions of that have been linked to cervical cancer in women. It initially started out that it was approved in the United States for young girls, starting at about 10 to 12 years old, the idea being you want them to be fully vaccinated before they're ever sexually active. Not that we're encouraging children to become sexually active early. We just want that medicine to get in. We want the vaccination to be able to build the immunity in their system before they ever come into contact with that virus. Recently now, that's been extended to young men. It not only that vaccine protects them from getting the virus themselves, but also then from passing that on to their future partners.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because it's the boys that give it to the girls in most instances, right?
It is, in effect, though, a cancer vaccine.
I mean, it is a cancer vaccine.
All of the social discussion aside, it is a cancer vaccine.
It is, and it has been shown to make a difference.
We just, for a moment, we have to jump over to Elaine at 282-1234 because we are talking about the child who is eating sand. Elaine maybe can kick that up a notch for us. Good morning, Elaine. What did your sister eat?
Burnt matches.
Oh, wow.
That would be like charcoal. It was the old wooden matches.
Sure. And she's okay now?
Well, no. That didn't hurt her any.
It didn't hurt her.
I just wondered if it was indicative of something she was missing in her diet.
Yeah.
It could have been.
That pica part of it that you talk about. Yeah. And so then that leads us to nutrition and then on to childhood obesity, which is probably one of the things that you have to work with as well.
Absolutely. You know, our society is such, many homes, both parents are working full time. Many children are involved in so many activities that a lot of the family meals are done on the run. That sometimes can mean fast food, or that can mean foods that are quick to prepare. We also have more and more opportunities to be sedentary, to sit still. So the screen time can affect that too. Biggest things are eating healthy whole foods and being active.
Dr. Heidi Stoltenberg, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Coming all the way from Albert Lee, we're glad to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. 2 hours of screen time a day, all for you.
Oh, boy.
Stay with us. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend. Next week, we'll talk about hearing loss with ear, nose, and throat specialist Dr. Colin Driscoll and audiologist Dr. Doug Sladen. Now, I know that you have noticed that I turn my volume up on my headphones fairly high.
Mine might be a titch too loud, louder than Heidi's were, but yours are louder than mine, so I'm going to throw you right under the bus next week.
Well, I know that's where I'm usually at,
yes.
So it won't bother me. That is, you know, there's a reason for that. It's age-related hearing loss. And there are about 30 million people in the United States who have hearing loss, not all of them age-related, but a lot of them are. And we'll talk about the different types of hearing loss and what hearing specialists can do to help. We'll talk about hearing aids and even the disposable kind and the new digital kind that are a little more expensive than the others. We'll find out if they're really worth it. We'll talk about cochlear implants. You know, doesn't Rush Limbaugh have a cochlear implant? You know, it is an absolute miracle for some people who are nearly totally deaf. And we'll talk about tinnitus, ringing in the ears. That's a common problem. We'll hear it all next week on Medical Edge Weekend.
I like what you did there. That's very impressive.
I hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org.
Or you can visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo Clinic share their expertise to empower you to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener is Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Medical Edge Weekend, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.